you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And not just the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Sarah Dowdy.
And I'm Deblina Chakraborty.
And earlier this year, some interesting news came out of Georgia Tech here in Atlanta. Researchers there announced that they'd come up with a texting app called Braille Touch, which applies computer braille, a specific type of braille, to touchscreen devices. And the app has mostly been in the news because it has potential as a general eyes-free texting app, even for people who aren't visually impaired. You could text under the table or something. But for folks who are visually impaired, a Braille app could really mean a lot less stuff to lug around. No keyboard, just a phone, and easier communication. And it really got me thinking about how much communication has improved for people with visual disabilities in the past century.
Yeah, and today we're going to revisit a subject that we touched on briefly in our Dickens Visits America episode, and it's kind of related to that topic of communication. It's about Laura Bridgman, who was the first deafblind person to learn language, also to communicate with letters and writing, and to be educated. And she didn't use the now ubiquitous Braille system that we just talked about, which was only beginning at the time, but instead she used the manual alphabet to spell out words, and she also read from raised Roman text and learned to handwrite with a special grid system.
So Bridgman was about 50 years older than the more famous Helen Keller. But if you remember from that earlier episode, their stories are really closely connected, aside from the fact that young Helen Keller annoyed Bridgman by stepping on her foot when the two of them met. But while Keller really became a champion of disability rights and an international figure, you know, somebody who's internationally famous, Bridgman was on the earlier end of the disability rights story. And in fact, when she started school in the 1830s, people were just starting to believe blind people could be educated. So the idea of educating a deafblind person, this deafblind girl, seemed completely impossible.
Yeah, so we're going to tell you a little bit about her early story and the challenges that she had to face before we get to that story of her learning. Laura Dewey Bridgman was born December 21st, 1829, near Hanover, New Hampshire. Her parents, Daniel and Harmony, had a farm, and Laura was their third daughter. She was a pretty baby with bright blue eyes, but she was really sickly. At 20 months, she finally started getting bigger and lively. She was chatty and seemed very smart. But at 24 months, she and her two older sisters came down with scarlet fever. Her two sisters died, but for Laura, the fever went on for weeks after that. And when she finally started to get better, she was blind in one eye, nearly blind in the other, deaf, and she had very little of her senses of smell and taste left. Her vision in her non-blind eye was destroyed when she walked into the spindle of her mother's spinning wheel.
So a really sad start here, but remarkably, by age four, she had recovered the strength she had lost during the fever. She was strong again, and while she wasn't talking anymore, she was still very smart. She was still displaying that interest she had as a two-year-old in everything she came across. She would touch everything she encountered. She'd cling to her mother and feel her arms and her hands and try to mimic her mother's hands. So she learned how to help out with housework that way. She even learned how to knit and to sew. And from a workman on her family farm, Asa Tenney, who himself had some impairments that made speech difficult for him, she did pick up some ability to communicate, or at least communicate more fully with her family. He had a way of sort of understanding what she was going through and helped her perfect this basic sort of sign language. And so each family member had a name sign that they could respond to. And a pat on her head meant yes or okay. A pat on her back meant no. She had a way of expressing really basic needs, at least.
But by age seven, she started throwing these really violent temper tantrums. She'd only obey her father, who would stomp on the ground when he was upset with her. And she'd reached the limit of communication, basically, with her family, and she was just overwhelmed.
And they were overwhelmed, too. They were busy farmers, and they didn't know what they were going to do to help her. So fortunately, at that time, an article was written by a Dartmouth professor on Laura's ability to sign, and that got the attention of Samuel Gridley Howe. And a few years earlier, actually the very same year Laura was born, Howe had founded Perkins, which was a school for the blind, and it had opened for students in 1832 with a mission not just to educate blind children, that's kind of how you'd see it today, but to really prove that blind children could be educated and could become independent adults.
Kids at the school learned everything from history to philosophy, plus sports, music, including piano tuning, and domestic work. So it was really a very broad education.
Getting them ready for life.
Howe's quite a character himself, we should mention. He idolized Lord Byron and fought in the Greek Revolution, where Byron died. He financially supported radical abolitionist John Brown, and he was married to Julia Ward, who wrote The Battle Hymn of the Republic. But he was also a proponent of education reform, and not just for blind students. He wanted rote memorization replaced with a curriculum following the child's interests. He disliked John Locke's idea of the tabula rasa, the blank slate, and instead thought that the mind came with certain innate facilities, something in line with the pseudoscience of phrenology.
Yeah, so when Howe heard about Laura, he realized that she would really be his perfect subject. She was an opportunity for him to do good. Clearly, he was very interested in that. She was excellent PR for his school, and she'd be a way for him to test his theories on the mind, and probably most importantly, a challenge for him. At this point, he was doing so successfully with his school, he wanted a challenge. So Laura's parents met with Howe, and they agreed to send her to Perkins, and Laura arrived there in October 1837 when she was just shy of 8 years old. She just got a little bit of time to settle into her new surroundings. She was obviously very scared, very disoriented, but Howe gave her 2 weeks to get used to the new world.
So after that generous two-week period that she got, he started to teach her. He quickly decided to scrap the basic sign language that she'd been using at home and instead teach her English. So here's kind of how it worked. He would give her something basic like a key or a fork or a knife that was labeled with embossed writing. And then after she familiarized herself with the objects, he'd separate the object from that label and she would have to match them to each other.
Yeah, and he wrote of this time, quote, "It was as though she were underwater and we were on the surface over her, unable to see her, but dropping a line and moving it about here and there, hoping it might touch her hand so that she would grasp it instinctively, hoping that she would put two and two together and realize it wasn't just a matching game. These labels actually signified something about the objects that they went with. But according to Jane Seymour Ford and Perkins, Hal believed that her ability to match really was just kind of a game. It was just memorization at this point. She liked getting approval, so she knew the knife label went with the knife and so on. So the next step for him was to cut up the labels into their separate letters. And he would spell out the word that she was familiar with and he'd jumble them up. And then he would leave Laura to figure out how to piece them back together again into something she was familiar with. And he describes the aha sort of moment when she finally got this, that letters made up words and words signified things. And he wrote, quote, "The truth began to flash upon her. Her intellect began to work. She perceived that here was a way by which she could herself make a sign of anything that was in her own mind and show it to another mind. And at once her countenance lighted up."
So from there, Laura tried to learn the name of every single thing that she encountered. Communication got faster when she learned the manual alphabet and could put aside those embossed letters that she'd initially learned with. She only needed about a year of instruction and vocabulary building before she could join in the regular classes for the blind. And she would have a personal teacher with her who was fingerspelling everything out for her so that she could follow along in class.
But other than that, just following along with the lessons, pretty remarkable. One thing to mention here, though, Hal promoted Laura's ability, that aha sort of moment. He promoted that as something innate, like she just had the capacity for language there. But two of her recent biographers, Elizabeth Jeter and Ernest Freeburg, suggest that she probably did have some distant memory of spoken language before she was deaf. Even if she might not have remembered being 2 years old, she probably had something left in her head. And Jeter also thinks that she had likely been imprinted with the capacity for grammar, since her later ability to understand all these different complex tenses kind of put her apart from a lot of other deafblind people who've learned language.
Which to me just sounds like another way of saying innate ability. So
maybe.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing Youth Activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All of that available at meaningfulbeauty.com.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and everybody. It's spring, and with the weather changing and so many great things coming up like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, I definitely need a fresh spring wardrobe for every occasion. This spring, I'm looking for that perfect flowy spring dress for Mother's Day, as well as replacing my everyday basics. That's what I love about JCPenney. They have so many stylish and comfortable options that I always find just what I'm looking for there. Spring is a feel-good season and comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. The fashion at JCPenney is the same way. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with styles that gets you, something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes, and Stafford and Mutual Weave for him, style and comfort for all, even big and tall. Plus even more for the whole family like Levi's and Exertion. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
So we should also point out that while Braille was by this point being used in some parts of the world, Laura and the other students at Perkins read with raised Roman letters, which was known as Boston line type, and it made for some really huge books.
Because they had to blow up the letters so big that you could actually feel the differences between them.
And Laura would write with a grooved guide that was slid under her paper. So you'd write a letter in one of the grooves, cover it, and then move on to the next letter. And it was called square handwriting.
Because it has this very strange sort of square look to it. You can see letters that Laura herself wrote, and it is a very unusual looking hand, but pretty remarkable.
It sounds really time consuming.
It does, but apparently she was a voracious letter writer, so she must have gotten pretty fast at it.
And while she studied reading, writing, and geography, and algebra, and geometry, and all the other subjects in the classroom, she would pepper her teachers with questions at the same time outside of the classroom. Things like, why don't flies have names? Why can't we sail to the sun in boats? If I eat fish hooks, could I be dead?
Burning questions.
Yes. And she flourished socially, too. She could recognize people that she hadn't seen in a long time by feeling their faces. She made distinct noises for friends, which were kind of like individual names that people could recognize, other people.
Mm-hmm. And Hal describes this sort of girlish social butterfly behavior that Laura had in a passage I really liked. He said, quote, when Laura's walking through a passageway with her hands spread before her, she notes instantly everyone she meets and passes them with a sign of recognition. But if it be a girl of her own age, and especially if one of her favorites, there is instantly a bright smile of recognition, an intertwining of arms, a grasping of hands, and a swift telegraphing upon the tiny finger. So I think that really conveys how happy she was to finally be able to communicate with people and say what was on her mind and hear what was going on in the world. And she'd joke around, too. That's another important thing to mention, because she does have a reputation being older as kind of severe. But as a kid, she'd joke around. She'd purposely misspell words and then strike it out with the other hand, or she would spell with her nose when fingerspelling instead of her fingers. She'd spin donuts on her fingers, something that she actually did her whole life. And when she was alone, too, she could entertain herself. She liked to always be able to ask people questions, but she could entertain herself. She kept a journal her whole life. She would practice new words, spelling out the names of new words. She would carry out these sort of private dialogues, and she would knit and sew and had a very strong sense of fashion. She was always very neatly dressed, very stylish. She'd sew all her own clothes and had some things that almost sound like amazing party tricks, too. She could thread a needle with her tongue. Just really cool talents that kind of get overshadowed by some of the other abilities, but just these everyday things she was also able to do in addition to reading and writing.
But even in spite of these more entertaining aspects of her personality and that sense of humor that she had, Laura would also still sometimes throw tantrums. And this was something that Howe, of course, didn't cover much in that PR campaign that made Laura so famous. She'd hit students sometimes, shove teachers. She would get very upset with slow finger spellers, too. And since she'd worked so closely with her teachers, sometimes spending 24 hours a day with them, she'd also form these really deep attachments and really truly suffer when changes happened. In her time at Perkins as a student, she had four main teachers. Lydia Drew Morton, Eliza Rogers, Mary Swift Lamson, and Sarah White Bond. And she stayed lifelong friends with all of them. But when they leave Perkins to marry or to get new jobs, she would beg to go with them. And when she would get upset when things like this would happen, she wouldn't be able to eat. And one of those really traumatic transitions came when Howe himself married Julia Ward in 1843. Laura had, of course, been Howe's pet project. He promoted her in medical journals, periodicals, children's magazines, enough to make them both internationally famous. But people from around the world would come to see her, sometimes just visiting, but sometimes just watching her behind partitions.
Which reminded me a little of some of the Barnum episodes we've been talking about, which this is around the same time. And I don't know, it's a more disturbing side of the story.
Yeah, and another kind of disturbing aspect of this, according to Louis Menand in The New Yorker, she was so well known, little girls would poke out their doll's eyes and name them Laura.
A very special kind of fame there.
Yes, but Laura also had kind of become Howe's adopted daughter by this point. According to Seymour Ford at Perkins, she even lived in his apartment with him and his sister, so they were really very close. So Laura was really feeling kind of abandoned when Howe married and spent a year and a half after that on a working honeymoon in Europe. She wrote to him constantly and often asked questions about one subject that she was particularly interested in learning more about, and that was religion.
So Howe had always planned to include religion in his process of educating Laura, but he had kind of strange ideas about it. You normally think of a religious education starting as young as possible, but he didn't think she should have any kind of religious instruction until her mid-teens, after her physical and intellectual educations were complete, at least to his idea. So he hoped that just as she had shown people possess some sort of natural innate understanding of language, or at least he believed that, she would also eventually show that people possessed an innate understanding and love of God. That was his hope. So his plan when he came back from his honeymoon was to present her, you know, he had a plan just like his labeling system. He would present her with these everyday miracles instead of everyday items like forks and knives. In this case, it would be something like plants growing from seeds. And he expected that if she were presented with enough of these, ultimately she'd realize, just as she'd realized those, the significance of those embossed letters, that there was something divine about these things, something divine about the whole process. And also, according to Menand, he hoped that these innate inclinations and understandings of hers would match up with his own Unitarian beliefs rather than more serious evangelical beliefs. So, to make sure that this plan of education worked, he knew that she needed to have no sort of religious instruction beforehand. So he banned her teachers from discussing religion while he was gone, from answering any kind of questions. And while she was writing him about religion, he himself didn't really answer questions in the letters. So she was left pretty frustrated and wondering what was going on.
Yeah, knowing curious Laura, by this point you can probably guess what happened. She managed to get something out of her teacher, Mary Swift, and she was also secretly visited by a group of evangelicals who were protesting Howe's methods. She was attracted to what they told her, and evangelical religion became a major part of her life from then on. When Howe finally came back, he was disappointed that his plan had been wrecked, and he kind of wrote the whole thing off as a failure.
Like, not just the religious education, but educating Laura almost.
Yeah, he became more distant from her after this. And according to Menand, he even said that her religious education was the greatest disappointment of his life, and it caused him to take back some of the praise he had for the blind in general. So he took a very extreme
view of this. He took it pretty
hard.
Definitely. But when Laura was about 20 years old, her last and favorite teacher, Sarah White, left to be married. And at this point, especially considering that she and Howe had drifted apart by this point a little bit, school was going to be over for Laura. So she stayed on at Perkins for a time, but she really found life a lot lonelier and isolated without having a constant companion with her anymore. So it was thought best by everyone that she go home to her family farm. That didn't really work out either. The family was too busy running the farm, doing their everyday things that they did. And they didn't have time for the 24-hour companionship and the constant questions that she was used to. And so she started to get depressed. She started to get sick. And Hal eventually got worried enough to loop in Dorothea Dix, who we've talked about on an earlier podcast, who was also a friend of Laura's, to help raise the money for a lifetime endowment for her to live at Perkins as long as she wanted to.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all 5 of her best-selling products, including the amazing youth-activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing 5-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory 5-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All that available at MeaningfulBeauty.com.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and everybody. It's spring, and with the weather changing and so many great things coming up like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, I definitely need a fresh spring wardrobe for every occasion. This spring, I'm looking for that perfect flowy spring dress for Mother's Day, as well as replacing my everyday basics. That's what I love about JCPenney. They have so many stylish and comfortable options that I always find just what I'm looking for there. Spring is a feel-good season and comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. The fashion at JCPenney is the same way. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with styles that gets you, something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes, and Stafford and Mutual Weave for him, style and comfort for all, even big and tall. Plus even more for the whole family like Levi's and Exertion. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
She ended up staying there for the rest of her life, returning to her family farm only for summers. As an adult at the school, she lived in a cottage and she taught needlework. Apparently, she was a really strict teacher, too. I think we mentioned that before at one point.
I think so. If you didn't have neat stitches, she'd just make you rip the whole thing out and start over.
That's tough. But she'd also read a lot. She'd write letters constantly. She'd travel occasionally, too. She'd knit. She'd embroider. She'd make lace and sew things to sell to people who who came to see her. Often she would include an attached autograph with that. And she liked having money of her own. She liked having some money to give to charity and buy presents for her friends. While she was home one summer, she was baptized in a brook near the family farm, and she also convinced the pastor's wife to learn the manual alphabet so that they could communicate, and that way Laura could get more religious instruction.
And we mentioned this a little bit when talking about her sense of humor, but to strangers, she did seem less friendly and less pleasant as she grew older, but perhaps that's in part due to all her losses. She got very close to her younger sister on these trips back to the farm, and her sister passed away. Howe died in 1876, and just within a year or so after that, two of her teachers died. So at age 59, Laura got sick with erysipelas, which is a streptococcus infection, and died May 24th, 1889. The last word that she spelled out was mother.
A year before she died, though, Laura did meet Helen Keller, and as we mentioned, the 8-year-old annoyed Laura by stepping on her foot.
So she was not a little too rambunctious.
Good, yeah, bad first impression. But Keller's parents, who were dealing with the same tantrums that Laura's family had dealt with years earlier, happened to read Dickens' 1842 American Travels, where, if you'll remember from the Dickens podcast, he wrote at length about the then sensational 12-year-old Laura, who was imprisoned in a, quote, marble cell.
He was very poetic in his descriptions of her.
And the promise of Laura's story made Keller's parents contact Perkins, where they were connected with recent grad Anne Sullivan, a good friend of Laura's and someone who was familiar with Howe's method of instruction. So the famous aha moment in Keller's story came when Sullivan spelled out water on Keller's hand while running water over the other. It's a very famous scene that I think we all probably
Miracle
learned
worker.
In grade school. Yep.
Exactly. And Keller is so close, or I guess I should say Bridgman is so closely connected with Keller because of that link in her parents and Dickens and all of that. But Keller did always acknowledge Bridgman's earlier education and its effect on her own life. But Laura's story is maybe best summed up with something that she said as a child when her teacher was explaining to her that while most people had 5 senses, she just had 3 senses. And according to Krista DeLuzio in American 19th Century History, Laura thought about this for a moment. And then she answered her teacher that no, she actually had one more sense than that. She had the sense of touch, she had taste, smell, and then a 4th sense, which she called think. And I mean, that, how does that not just sum up everything she learned and did, that you can think, but if you have the ability to express it, you can live a full life?
Yeah, and it really was kind of a sense for her. It made her be able to function in a way that, you know, quote, typical people could.
It did. So I found Laura Bridgman's story very interesting, and maybe still consider doing something on Helen Keller. Louis Braille, too, another
that
guy
would be,
I ran into.
Yeah.
In this research process, all very interesting characters, but I think that's probably a good time for us to go to listener mail. So this email is from Matt, and he wrote to us about our real life Indiana Jones episode, and here's what he had to say. I'm a professional archaeologist who spends a good deal of time trying to explain what my job is really like. Fieldwork is a part of what I do, though it is a professional undertaking and not an adventurous one. But I also spend a lot of time writing reports, researching regulations, and speaking with government officials. In other words, my job better resembles an episode of Parks and Recreation than Raiders of the Lost Ark. I love Parks. He went on to say, I've also discovered that being listed in the phone book under archaeologists often results in odd people bringing odd objects to my office. A few weeks ago, I was called over to the office of one of the other archaeologists who works for my company. A woman was sitting in his extra chair while he stood over his desk, staring down at 3 items spread out on it. A large chunk of sandstone with a crude face carved on it, a pestle carved from an unknown stone with a strange ridge pattern on the handle, and a soapstone carving of a crouching man with his hands clenched at his chest. My coworker took photos and we both asked questions. Seems that the objects were given to this woman by an elderly lady who had once lived on a large estate in Mexico. However, our visitor's grasp of Spanish coupled with the donor's grasp of English were insufficient to allow a more detailed description of the item's provenance to be gained. So, we have sent the photos on to a few people we know who are experts in Aztec and Mesoamerican archaeology. While this will, of course, have a mundane resolution, we'll find out what these objects are and let her know, but it should be noted we will not discuss the monetary value of them, as we do not want to encourage looting. This seems like the sort of thing that belongs in an adventure movie. A woman, who naturally was a redhead dressed all in black, comes by our office asking our opinion about three mysterious artifacts that came to her by way of a convoluted route, and she can't find information on what they are or what, if anything, they mean. I spend a lot of time trying to disabuse people of the notion that my job in any way resembles an Indiana Jones story, and then this happens. So we thought that was pretty funny, and he said that one of these days they're just expecting some guy in a trench coat to come by and, you know. You can imagine the rest from there.
Yeah, I mean, if any funny supernatural
where the drama
stuff,
would start.
I know, yeah.
So thank you, Matt, for writing in and sharing a little peek into the life of a real archaeologist. Sounds pretty fun.
It does. It sounds more exciting than I think you think your job is. I mean, we sit in cubicles all day, so.
We do. So, yeah, Parks and Recreation sounds pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. So if you'd like to write with us and share some personal experiences you have that are related to podcast topics we've done, or maybe you just have a podcast topic that you want to suggest, you can write to us and let us know. We're at historypodcast@discovery.com. You can also look us up on Facebook, and we're on Twitter at Mist in History.
And if you want to learn a little bit more about Braille, we do have an article called How Braille Works. You can look for that by searching for Braille on our homepage at www.howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR. The Motor Racing Network. Work.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.